Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. And this week we have a variety of articles for you from different sections of the magazine, starting with higher education. Before she took historic moon photos, Christina Koch honed her skills in NC. And the article is by Corey Dean. A flip through the online archives of NC State University's technician from the start of the millennium pulls up headlines and scenes you'd expect from a student newspaper. University administrators meeting with student leaders. A new director of the Alumni Association. Updates on campus construction projects. Eagle-eyed readers might spot a familiar name attached to the page's photos. Christina Hammock. That's how she was known before she married and became Christina Koch, the name more closely associated with a history-making NASA career, in which she recorded the longest space flight by a woman, participated in the first all-female spacewalk, and became the first woman to orbit the moon. Koch attended NC State from 1997 to 2002 and earned undergraduate degrees in physics and electrical engineering, as well as a master's degree in the latter. That's a combination of disciplines that one of Koch's physics professors described to the Assembly as one of the most difficult at the university, but her studies apparently didn't prevent her from staying busy outside the classroom. Among other activities, Koch was a member of the sailing club, participated in community service, and took up rock climbing. She also found time to take more than a dozen photos for the technician in the early 2000s. Her portfolio runs the gamut. There are multiple action shots of the Wolfpack women's soccer team. A two-page spread from the 2000 NC State Fair includes four images by Koch, the most of any photographer who contributed to the feature. And slices of campus life abound, like a front-page image of several raging grannies outside D.H. Hill Library, and another of two professors smoking a pipe and shooting the shit. This year, Koch was credited with taking Earthset, an historic image of our planet sinking below the moon's horizon as part of the Artemis II space mission in April. It bears significant similarities to Earthrise, the iconic photograph taken on the Apollo 8 mission in 1968. Koch hung the latter on her college dorm room's wall. On a NASA podcast in 2019, Koch said she's always considered photography a hobby and that it was among the tasks she was most looking forward to once she reached the International Space Station that year. She has also spoken of taking a high-speed photography class as a student at the NC School of Science and Math, the prestigious residential high school that is part of the UNC system. "I was famous for my time in the darkroom there," she told a group of NCSSM and NC State students while she was aboard the space station. She wasn't available for an interview for this story, per a NASA spokesperson. James Curl, who served as the technician's photo editor while Koch was on staff, recalled her as a quiet but driven presence. She seemed drawn to the idea of documenting her surroundings, and she was always trying to bring back better images to the newsroom than she did on her previous assignments, Curl said. "I think that desire for improvement and wanting to capture what she was seeing in the world around her translated into her career with NASA," Curl said. Indeed, the girl who grew up near the North Carolina coast, loving things that made her feel small, the ocean, the night sky, seemingly never stopped pursuing opportunities that would bring her closer to her dream of going to space. The power of creativity. Koch, 47, was born in Michigan, but moved to Jacksonville as a child and calls North Carolina home. With parents from scientific backgrounds who kept National Geographic and Popular Mechanics around the house, she told the News and Observer in 2016 that she took an early interest in exploring the world around her and tinkering with machines and tools in the backyard shed. Newspaper clips from Cox's childhood show she excelled academically, earning a spot on the honour roll at her elementary school, St. Francis of Assisi, in third grade. As a seventh grader at Hunters Creek Middle School in 1992, she was recognised by Duke University's Talent Identification Program for her scores on the SAT. The following year, she earned first place at the state's Southeast Regional Science Fair for a project on the common sense of geometric formulas. But it wasn't all books for Koch. I was a cheerleader that had to take off from cheerleading camp to get an academic award at Duke University in middle school, she recalled in an NC State interview in 2021. At White Oak High School in Jacksonville, which Koch attended before transferring to NCSSM in Durham, she cheered alongside her friend, Melanie Edwards. NASA included a photo of the pair in their Vikings cheer uniforms in its 2013 announcement of Koch's astronaut class and in an Instagram video the agency posted shortly before the Artemis II mission. Honors classes, cheerleading, she moved through all of it without seeming overwhelmed, Edwards told the assembly by email recently. What I remember most is that her curiosity was never confined to the classroom. Koch, though, has said she's not without doubts. In a recent interview with Oprah Winfrey, she reflected on a sculpture of her that sits at the main entrance to the NCSSM campus in Durham, saying that she worries it is too perfect of a representation of her and might discourage students from following their dreams. In a speech she gave at the sculpture's dedication, Koch said, "She made sure to talk about the person I was in high school and how unsure I was of myself." Koch also took an interest in the arts. In seventh grade, Koch told the Daily News of Jacksonville that band was her favorite class. "The music relaxes you and takes your mind away from school stress." Perhaps that explains why Koch was disappointed when Mission Control cut off Chapel Rowan's Pink Pony Club, played to wake up the Artemis II crew on their fourth flight day, before the chorus. Koch was also featured in a 1997 NNO story about how the School of Science and Math encouraged students to foster their own theories of creativity. In one class, Koch told the paper she learned from her teacher to draw only what you see rather than what you think you see, a lesson that likely came in handy as she recorded her observation of the moon with paper and pencil after her computer failed in space. At NCSSM, Koch realized the power of creativity, she told students in 2019. She said she also learned how to turn fear into focus by staring down the mountain of homework that faced her each night and later applied that lesson to her first spacewalk. "I really just can't say enough about the different opportunities that I had that led me to want to live a life to explore," she said of her NCSSM experience. Joining the Wolfpack. Koch landed at NC State because of its strong physics and electrical engineering programs. She knew she wanted to study both, she told former NC State Chancellor Randy Woodson in 2023, because the former catered to her interest in the theories behind the universe and the latter to her love of tinkering and applying knowledge to hands-on scenarios. "It helped that the university was in her home state. I could be at a public university, which is meant to support the people that are local, that are North Carolinians, and that have so much pride in this state," she told Woodson, "and NC State just represented doers." She excelled in Raleigh, even with a heavy course load. "If the work weighed on Koch, she didn't let it show," said Steve Reynolds, Koch's academic advisor in the physics department, who hired her for a summer research project in 1999. "She was just always happy, it seemed like," he said. John Blondin, a physics professor who taught Koch in upper-level courses and supervised her on that research project, recalled that Koch signed her homework assignments like a classic 19-year-old college girl, with her nickname Tina, often with a heart drawn as the dot above the eye. Koch was quick to volunteer for one of the most challenging tasks on the research project, which involved coding. Blondin said, She also made a Tesla coil during her downtime that summer just because she thought it would be cool, Reynolds said. She was just so energetic, Reynolds said. It sort of makes me tired just to think about it. Blondin and Reynolds learned early in their work with Koch that she wanted to be an astronaut, and both believed she could accomplish the feat despite the long odds. Reynolds offered a vote of confidence in a recommendation letter he wrote to accompany Koch's application for an astronaut scholarship during her sophomore year. Christina Hammack is an exceptional individual in every way. Least interestingly, she has essentially a 4.0 GPA. More telling is her motivation for excellence in school, a lifelong dream to join the space program, Reynolds wrote. At NC State, her overpowering desire to learn and understand are evident in every class, but she extends her interests beyond the classroom as well, giving evidence of a deep scientific curiosity. Such quantitative talent is rarely found in as articulate, enthusiastic, and personable an individual as Ms. Hammack. But Koch knew it would take more than academic success to become an astronaut. She has described walking away from a class on how to be an astronaut at space camp, which she attended every summer from 1992 to 1996, with a feeling that she didn't want to live her life according to a checklist. Instead, she would live by her passions, and if in the course of those pursuits she felt she gained the experiences necessary to contribute to the space program, she would apply. That outlook took Koch to research stations in Antarctica, Alaska, and American Samoa before she got the call from NASA. At NC State, her work for the technician combined the artful hobbies that she'd discovered growing up with her gift for observing her surroundings. Curl, the former technician photo editor, said Koch had a knack for finding and documenting visually interesting scenes on campus that would often run as standalone photos on the front page. It was pretty clear from the jump that she was not just someone who had a casual interest in photography, he said. It was clear that she had an eye for it. Curl said he had little, if anything, to do with Koch's photography skills, which she further honed with 20 hours of specialized photography instruction as part of her Artemis mission training. But as Koch documented the moon this spring, Curl thought about what she learned all those years ago at the technician and whether that influenced her work now. Maybe if the other astronauts needed assistance with their image composition, he thought, they could lean on Koch. For some folks, these are just pictures, Curl said, but I like to think that Christina appreciated the art and the beauty of it as she was making that journey and capturing those images. That certainly appears to be the case. In an April 7th call between Koch's Artemis II crew and the astronauts aboard the International Space Station, she reflected, "The thing that changed for me looking back at Earth was that I found myself noticing not only the beauty of the Earth, but how much blackness there was around it, and how it made it even more special. It truly emphasized how alike we are, how the same thing keeps every single person on planet Earth alive," she said. "We evolved on the same planet. We have some shared things about how we love and live that are just universal, and the specialness and preciousness of that really is emphasized when you notice how much else there is around it." Well, next we have an article from Faith and Religion. "These church members disagree on politics. Together, they're wiping out medical debt." And this is an article by Noam N. Levy. "Some issues like immigration or student loans are too divisive to unite Trinity Moravian Church. We've got quite a record of quite a spread of political beliefs," said the Reverend John Jackman, who leads this 114-year-old red brick church near Winston-Salem's old textile mills. "Conservative Republicans sit with liberal Democrats. Supporters of President Donald Trump mix with his fierce critics. It's definitely a purple congregation," Jackman said. But 4 years ago, when Jackman suggested a new church mission to alleviate medical debt for residents of the wider Winston-Salem area, there was no dissent. "This is the easiest money I've ever raised," he said. "All I do is tell people what we're doing and they write me a check." Few issues have been more politically explosive in recent years than healthcare, pitting Democrats and Republicans in bitter debates over the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid, and other flashpoints. Yet, moved by the sense that the medical debts their neighbours faced were deeply unfair, members of Trinity Moravian, no matter their politics, rushed to write $25 or $50 checks to pay off bills. They helped advance a movement by churches across the state and the country and inspired North Carolina government officials to tackle medical debt. The effort drew plaudits from conservative radio host Glenn Beck. The little church's success is also highlighted a patch of common ground in American healthcare: widespread anxiety and frustration that so many patients are ending up in debt. Earlier this year, Trinity wrapped up its 8th medical debt campaign, part of what the church calls its Debt Jubilee Project. This one raised more than $17,000. That helped retire more than $2.2 million in debt. Medical debt can be bought for pennies on the dollar because creditors believe most debts won't be paid. Nationwide, an estimated 100 million adults have some form of healthcare debt. More than half of US adults have had such debt at some point. At Trinity Moravian Church, which has about 200 members, it wasn't hard to find stories of crushing medical bills. "I see people going into debt every minute of every day," said Catherine Coe, who works in the accounting department of a hospital system. "We're all just one medical bill from financial ruin." Coe grew up coming to Trinity with her grandmother. She drifted away from the church as an adult before rejoining the congregation last year. Coe, who describes herself as a conservative, voted for Trump. Terry Mabe, who's been coming to Trinity for decades, is on the other side of the nation's political divide. She said she can't stand the president, who, she said, had no real concern for the people of this country. Mabe, 70, has also seen medical debt up close. She used to work in the construction industry. "In between projects, you are a lot of times without a job," she said. "Then you get sick. Next thing you know, you owe $5,000, $10,000 that you cannot pay. You're barely paying your home bills. Then you're like, I can't pay it. What do I do now?" Both Coe and Mabe said partisan differences don't matter. "There isn't a political divide when it comes to medical debt," Coe said. "It all brings us together." Jackman said he got the idea to do something about medical debt during the pandemic, when growing numbers of people turned to the church for help. "I was hearing about the reason they couldn't pay their electric bill was because they'd had a few days in the hospital. Then they got hit with this huge bill and it snowballed," he recalled. "And I started hearing this again and again and again." Jackman learned about a non-profit called Undue Medical Debt that buys unpaid medical bills from hospitals and debt collectors so the debts can be retired. The church's first campaign in 2022 set a goal of raising $5,000 to retire about $500,000 in medical debt owed by residents of surrounding Forsyth County. The campaign hit its goal in just 6 weeks, fueled mostly by donations of less than $50. Jackman, who's been a pastor for more than 4 decades, attributed part of the success to an ethos of the church. "One of our ideas is that we cannot fix everything, but we have to fix what we can in the place where we're planted," he said. Trinity members, no matter their political leanings, also said they see something broken in a system that pushes sick people into debt. Paul Sluder, 78, who doesn't identify with a political party, used to work for a credit union. He said he did a lot of debt collecting before he retired. "Most people," he said, "wanted to pay what they owed. If they got sick, they often had no choice but to go into debt. You have kind of no control. You have to take care of yourself or your loved ones," Sluder said. "It's incredibly unfair, and I think the system's out of whack." In a 2025 survey for undue medical debt, more than 75% of Republicans and Democrats said collection agencies shouldn't be allowed to garnish patients' wages to pay medical debt. And in recent years, bipartisan measures to expand protections from medical debt have passed in blue and red states. Coe, a Republican, said she would support even more limits on how much medical debt people could be forced to carry. Why can't we cap medical debt at a certain dollar amount, and after that it's either written off or forgiven? She asked. After completing the most recent debt campaign, Trinity hosted a special ceremony, assisted by kids from a local scouting group. Jackman stood before the congregation and held up a piece of paper with a long list of names, people in the county whose debt had been bought and retired by the church. On this day of Jubilee, Jackman announced, we act to forgive the debts of many of our neighbours as God has forgiven our debts. As the congregation stood, Jackman flicked on a lighter and burned the list of 1,631 names. The paper was consumed by a yellow flame. The scouts set off confetti poppers, the choir sang, and the congregation erupted in cheers. Afterwards, members went downstairs for a spaghetti lunch in the church basement, served by the scouts. Reflecting on the day's festivities, many members of the congregation said they hoped their work on medical debt could inspire others to bridge political differences and work together. There's just so much division, so much anger, said Cynthia Tesh, 72. We need to look out for one another, she said. If we start looking out for one another, things will change. If we start considering other people and not just ourselves, things will change. Well, our final article for today is another higher education one. Why Davidson College is offering free tuition to families making less than $175,000. And it's an article by Tori Newby. As the cost of higher education rises nationwide, Davidson College announced this month that it is joining several universities across the state in offering free tuition for some families. Starting in fall 2027, the university will cover tuition for new students from families earning less than $175,000. Families earning less than $85,000 will have all costs covered, including housing and meals. Davidson joins several universities in the state that are experimenting with free tuition, in addition to institutions elsewhere, including Harvard University and the University of Pennsylvania. Duke University offers free tuition for families from North Carolina and South Carolina earning $150,000 or less, and UNC Chapel Hill offers it for in-state families earning $80,000 or below. In North Carolina, some schools are slashing costs to attract new students amid enrollment challenges, while others aim to remain accessible to lower income families. Davidson tuition alone costs $73,090 for incoming first-year students, and the total cost of attendance is nearly $93,000. That puts the Charlotte Area College just behind Duke, which charges more than $96,000. About 70% of Davidson's 2,000 students currently receive some sort of financial aid, with 50% of students receiving need-based aid. Davidson also pledged in 2007 to meet 100% of students' need without any loans. Davidson President Doug Hicks said he anticipates the new free tuition financial aid structure will help between 50 and 100 additional students per year. This effort is doubling down on our commitment to access and affordability to recruit the best and brightest students to Davidson, regardless of their family's ability to pay. And it's also making clearer and simpler what that cost might actually be, Hicks said. The Assembly called Hicks to learn more about what this new policy will do for Davidson and how the university is affording it. How might this new free tuition plan encourage more students to apply? We do think it will widen our applicant pool. It will help prospective students to see that they should go ahead and apply, knowing that the financial aid package they'll receive will help cover costs at Davidson. And we certainly hope that with this commitment to financial aid and the overall excellent education we offer, this will also then yield more students from across the socioeconomic spectrum. In higher ed, we hear a lot about the missing middle. How will offering free tuition help address this? This is a direct effort to address the challenge that low and middle income families face. So looking at the overall income distribution in America, I see that families earning $175,000 or less reaches well into the middle class, and in fact reaches about 4 in 5 families. So about 80% of US families will be eligible. For families earning $175,000 or more, our current policies will still apply, where we meet 100% of calculated need. And so families close to but above $175,000 are going to get significant grants towards tuition. And so those programs will continue above the 80th percentile of families in the income distribution, if you will. So we're doing what we can to make college accessible and affordable on up well beyond the middle class. How does this build on what Davidson already offers? This past year, we spent $80 million on financial aid. This coming year that we are just entering, we'll spend $85 million, and our projection is in the ballpark of $90 million with this new structure. So in a nutshell, the amount we spend on financial aid is massive. For many of these families under $175,000 in income, many of them are already getting full tuition. This guarantees it. This makes it more systematic and clear for families. And I also want to mention, for many families who are in the income bracket of under $85,000, most of those families are already receiving nearly a full scholarship. How will the university pay for this? Our endowment is largely comprised of money designated for financial aid, so endowed scholarships. 70% of our endowment payout each year that we receive goes straight into the pockets of students as financial aid. Our finances would not work as a college, as a private college, without generous donors and specifically an endowment that builds over time. We also benefit from annual fund donors who give to financial aid and scholarships on a current basis and annual basis. We get a return from the endowment each year. That's under 5% of the value of the endowment on a rolling average, but that will cover about 2/3 of the $90 million, and the other money comes from annual donors as well as deductions from our operating budget. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of the Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, and if you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. If you have any requests for in-depth NC reporting, please also call 919-832-5138. 3-8.